What we're doing today is we're trying to destroy the crop.
You're hearing a group of activists going through a GM wheat field by Syngenta, the agrochemical company, ripping out the crops left and right in the UK in 2003.
We're wearing decontamination suits so that we don't contaminate the outside areas.
I also feel that we should be moving towards a form of agriculture which is more working in harmony with nature.
So what actually have you done?
We've just killed 100% of it. Syngenta's GM wheat. It's not resistant to protesters. We got it.
The UK has been pretty intense in the anti-GM movement, and the author of the book that we will talk about today, called Seeds of Science, was actually part of it. He used to be an anti-GM activist. But since then, he switched sides and is telling people about the benefits of GMOs. And indeed, scientists who want to use genetic engineering technology to actually improve the world have a really hard time. Roughly 10 years after this incident, scientists at Rothamsted Research in England started an airfield trial of genetically modified wheat again, but this one was publicly funded. The wheat was sown behind a high fence and protected by 24-hour security, necessary in this case. The aim of the research was to test whether an added gene could repel aphids. These small sucking insects are commonly called greenfly or blackfly. The wheat would exude a pheromone that aphids just don't like. A pheromone is a chemical produced by an organism that influences other individuals of the same species. We humans have pheromones, and they are pretty important for figuring out with whom we vibe or not, who we like to smell and who we don't like to smell. The theory was that if wheat can exude these unattractive pheromones, the insects would just stop attacking it. If you think about it, it's a great approach. But the stakes were high because a group of anti-GMO protesters had vowed to destroy the test site before the experiment could offer any results. In response, the scientists released a passionate video appealing to the media and pleading that their effort was actually to reduce pesticides. One of the scientists, Toby Bruce, addressed the camera directly. He said, and I quote the book on page 50, "We have developed this new variety of wheat, which doesn't require treatment with an insecticide, and it uses a natural aphid repellent, which already widely occurs in nature and is produced by more than 400 different plant species. We have engineered this into the wheat genome so that the wheat can do the same thing and defend itself. Are you really against this? Because it could have a lot of environmental benefit. Or is it simply you distrust it because it is a GMO?" Another Rothamsted scientist in the video was Janet Martin, who asked quite reasonably, "You seem to think, even before we've had a chance to test the trial, that our GM wheat variety is bad. But how can you know this?" She paused and uttered a wary, unscripted sigh before continuing, "It's clearly not through scientific investigation, because we've not even had the chance to do any tests yet." As Mark Lunas describes in his book Seed of Science, the video and associated public appeal seemed to strike a chord. Press coverage was largely sympathetic to the predicament of the scientists, a striking change from a decade earlier when the activists seemed to be leading the agenda. The Rothamsted science research had invested so much staff time, millions of pounds, and a lot of institutional reputation in fighting a campaign on behalf of the experiment. And unfortunately, when the results came in, the GM wheat did not repel aphids as expected. But they were not trying to bury the bad news. The team published an open access paper stating straightforward that field trials showed no reduction in aphids. Well, that's the nature of science, right? And maybe it doesn't work. That's why it's research. But the issue here is that it's really hard to try. It's really hard to research. And unfortunately, GM has gotten such a bad rap across the board that any kind of application of GM is facing boycotts. Today, our discussion is based on Mark Lunas' book, Seeds of Science. It was originally published in 2018. And as I later also describe, it's a balance, right? If we only look at one side of the story, we will always have an imbalanced view. So we do need to look at the other side of the story, which Seeds of Science offers us. We will try to find a silver lining between the murky extremes, looking at BT crops, use cases for poor communities, and cases of overregulation. If you don't have any context on genetic engineering, consider actually checking out our two previous episodes to get a bit more context. Otherwise, a big thanks and a shout out to the Adalbert Raps Foundation, located in the south of Germany, supporting independent food science research. More on them in a bit. Let's jump right in. Red to Green is the most in-depth podcast on food sustainability. And in this season 7, we discuss key takeaways from books on the food system. I'm your host, Marina Schmidt, and I'm joined by my co-host, Frank Kühne.
And that's the title of the book, Seeds of Science. I thought we're talking about like the seedlings within the science and then with about genetic modification. I wasn't aware that he was actually talking about seeds, because that's what he's doing.
It's interesting that, and for example, he doesn't touch on precision fermentation at all, which usually requires genetically modified organisms or like per definition of them, right?
Yeah.
So I always look out for content density, for how much am I highlighting in a book and how much is there just superfluous blah, blah. So either it should entertain me or it should educate me. And with his book, like the first 15%, and I know because I was reading it on my Kindle, the first 15% of this book were literally just about him.
You might like criticize the lengths he's going about it and himself, his role in it. But isn't it a crucial information? He's basically saying, I was a non-GMO activist in UK and actually a front runner in that whole movement. And I changed my mind about that. I think that's kind of part of his story and you need to understand if you're reading his book.
What I find interesting is that both of these, and he also sees like he was very radicalized in this first belief system in being completely anti-GMO in any kind of way, no matter what, like whatever was GMO per definition is bad. And now he's sort of not completely, but pro most applications. He sort of defended Monsanto and said, actually, it's not that bad compared to other companies also. And yeah, so I think it's a bit binary. Yeah.
Would you be able to summarize his position towards GMO crops now? Like, I'd like to make the difference between the use of genetic modification or editing in the science world and total medical or food system or wherever you're going to use it, and the focus he has on genetic modified crops. And do you understand his position on that? Like, he's pro genetic modification of crops, but is he like asking certain limitations what we should put into place?
It's mostly let's go for it and they are all safe, and all of like these and these institutions say there's a consensus on this being absolutely safe and no need to worry about it.
Let's have Mark Lunas describe his position himself. Actually, he does that on page 10. I quote, I'm using the terms GMO, GM, and GE somewhat interchangeably in this book. The first of these is especially problematic. I've used it in the title because it has the highest international recognizability factor, but many scientists I know refuse to use it on principle. What is a genetically modified organism anyway? Your pet dog is genetically modified from the original wolf. Otherwise, you wouldn't let it anywhere near your kids. All our crops and domesticated animals have been genetically modified from their ancestors to be useful to humans. So are they also GMOs? That's what bugs the scientists. It makes no logical sense to single out anything that has been altered in the lab for special concern or even vilification. Changing genes via laboratory molecular techniques, the main subject of this book, is not much different from conventional selective breeding. End quote. Genetic modification is a really broad term, and it includes any alteration to an organism's genetic material. So actually, GM indeed is an unfitting term. What we usually refer to when we say GMOs is a crop that has been genetically engineered. So, and genetic engineering is a specific technique or process used to actively modify an organism's DNA by inserting, deleting, or modifying specific DNA sequences. These genetic engineering techniques enable changes that go beyond the natural process. So let's say in molecular farming, if you make a soy plant produce casein, that's a milk protein. It's very unlikely that even if you would have bred this plant hundreds of times, that suddenly a soy plant produces milk proteins.
I missed a part where he basically says, like kind of this balanced perspective where he says there are the opportunities and the positive effects that it might have for the society or for the environment, for us in general. And on the other side, as with all new developments, we need to put some control institutions in place. Like there needs to be a balanced approach. But I couldn't find that in this book. That was fairly surprising for me. I thought at least that you would come at one point to this thing where you basically say, yeah, there's potential, but there's risk and that you need to handle it.
That was my main caveat with the book, because the first page starts out saying, actually, genetic engineering, that's the same as traditional plant breeding. That's his line of thought. And that's actually what regulation in the US was based on. If we think back to the world according to Monsanto, the thought pattern was, well, it's just DNA, you know, it's like DNA is natural, so it can come. It's just, we can take it from a different animal and insert it in this. It's just DNA, it doesn't matter. But the thing that trips me up is, and I'm not a scientist here, so we are approaching this just from trying to apply some common sense to it, right? That traditional plant breeding, and even if you would use radiation or something on these plants, you would never have a plant produce milk protein, no matter what you do to the soy plant, except if you do genetic engineering. So how can you compare it to traditional breeding? How can you apply the same regulatory framework as to traditional breeding in that way? It seems a bit far-fetched.
Yeah, I agree. That is, from my point of understanding and what I know now about the whole thing, it's not the same. I would clearly make a difference between breeding and editing or engineering of genes.
I do think he has some good points. It reminded me, my sister, her background is in science and biology, but she is very much into politics. She used to tell me to get the whole picture of a situation, she would read the English newspaper, the German newspaper, the Russian, and the Ukrainian one. And none of them ever state the whole truth. All of them have somewhat realistic points here and there, if you know where to look for. But when you read them all, you can get to a picture. And that's, I think, the value of reading that book. So I think just reading this book would be incomplete. Just reading the Monsanto book would be a bit incomplete. But in combination, it gives a more nuanced perspective on it. For example, I do think he brushes aside the main use of GMOs, which is for glyphosate-resistant crops. But he also, later in the book, points out that actually it didn't lead to a reduction of pesticide use, because in the end, it just shifted the world's pesticide use to glyphosate. And now, again, glyphosate-resistant weeds are coming up. But he focuses on BT crops in his book.
From my understanding, genetic modified crops do offer a lot more, let's call it, for us than only the use of pesticides or reducing the amount of pesticides using on the fields. Like, and there's drought resistance, there's, I don't know, health benefits. Like, there are other things that you can approach with GM crops.
In the episode of this biotech season, Larissa Zimbaroff, she was saying, when she talks to all these startups in the food tech space, doing precision fermentation, doing cellular agriculture, actually health is like the last thing any of them mention, because you have so many other things to care about: price, taste, distribution, etc. And that's, I think, also similar in this case, that in theory, you could make crops which are so much more healthy, but where are they? Like pink pineapple? Really? Is that what the world needs?
Money in it. There's no money in it. It's about profit, Marina. How do you sell more for a lower price?
Back to the basics, right? Back to the economics class.
Yeah, there you go. We're not in the game for healthy food. We're in the game for making money. Yeah. Oh, God. The industry is going to kill me. I've been an industry guy and somehow linked to the science community. I'm always worried about attacking genetic modification as the general bad thing and missing out the opportunities that has or that will be in that kind of technology. And it's quite young technology. Okay, it's 40 years old, but still trying to understand how this works. And I think there's going to be huge jumps over the next two decades. GM will stick. Like, it will be part of our society. And we rather should have a discussion about how it can work.
I think that's really about having a nuanced approach. It is a socio-political issue. It is also tied to who has the patents, and that is mainly Monsanto, now Bayer. And he also admits that, for example, BT crops, which are genetically engineered to be resistant to certain insects, all of the BT patents are now with Bayer. So he talks about this case in Africa and Tanzania, where there's a science institution which got an exemption, so they don't need to pay Monsanto royalties because the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation funded this research for, I think, BT maize in Africa. But then he says, oh, what's keeping this from being adopted is mostly activists. And if activists wouldn't be against GMOs, then the benefits for small, poor communities would already be way more apparent and way more popular.
Indeed, BT crops are actually quite interesting to look into. So this bacterial insecticide is a biopesticide. So it comes from an actual soil bacterium. And already in the 60s, we knew that it is non-toxic to mammals and fish, but also to other beneficial or non-target insects. You can spray the BT biopesticide, but the issue is it has drawbacks, as Unas describes on page 98 of his book. I quote, "It could not get to insects feeding within the plant's tissues, nor down in the roots, and it quickly degraded when exposed to open air in the field. Even so, it was effective enough to be in widespread commercial use in the 1970s and 1980s. And as a biopesticide, it was particularly popular among organic farmers, who were required to avoid the use of synthetic chemicals." A bit later, he describes, "Genetic engineers made even better use of BT by splicing the bacterial gene into the plant genome, thereby making crops express and produce this insecticidal protein directly inside." And Mark Lunas has a really interesting point here that he says, Monsanto pretty much had a choice. They could have led with BT corn or with Roundup Ready soy. And they decided to focus on the herbicide-resistant Roundup Ready soy. The earliest BT corn product was only released a year later, in 2097. And that was probably a huge mistake. Because, as Mark Lunas writes, I quote, "So the first GMO food product launched kicked off a decades-long controversy about herbicide tolerance and whether Monsanto was simply trying to sell more chemicals, while the subsequent insecticide-reducing BT seeds simply got lost in the noise."
The question which came into my mind when reading the book was, there's two topics. He's not really separating them properly, but I think it's crucial to do that. The system we are now in, which is driven by companies like Monsanto, and I think is the other one, and DuPont, they play the big scale patented profit-oriented game within GMO in general. With the example you just made, means smaller, poorer farmer actually can't afford that because they don't have the assets, the money to buy the more expensive things, or they're going to get into a liability towards these big companies, which then again brings up a whole other basket of issues. But that's the one topic or the one area. On the other side, I think that's what he's trying to say in the book is, in general, GMO could offer solutions for poorer farmers if they were put into place to actually use it, don't be dependent on a lot of money to use it, and so on.
Yeah, but I think it's important to consider that the possibilities, like the use case of a technology, is very much dependent on that. So if you argue for we should completely deregulate GMOs and just make it super easy for new GMO plants to be developed. He was talking about, I think it was Thailand, which had 40 different genetically modified crops work in progress. And then activists sort of jumped in and destroyed any seedlings. And there's a lot of activist action in destroying the actual crops and destroying the fields. And I think it's just really important to look at it case by case. If it's a university, if it's a government-funded social project, which is actually focused on how can we really improve drought resistance of crops? How can we? There's no better solution. Like there, you cannot do it with computational breeding. You cannot do it with something less invasive. And there are no existing crops that could just be better for this area. If that's the situation, then maybe it makes sense to do that and to go down that route. But yeah, it seems to me like the case by case judgment of it, to say it's a technology, right? Like it's just the way you go about things. And unless you say that it is morally apprehensive to in any way genetically engineer anything in this world, then it makes sense to say whether you use it to increase herbicide tolerance or whether you actually decrease herbicide use by making it directly resistant to insects, or whether you want to make it drought resistant. Those are three very different cases. It's very dangerous to try to come to some kind of conclusion based on these two books. Maybe we can just go and look at like how would you try to make up your mind, right? Because to really make up one's mind about this, I think it would require an entire red to green season just on the topic of GMOs.
So please comment if you want to have a season on that. I'm going to clearly listen
any,
to that.
Any research organization? Yes, sure. Monsanto would probably fund me.
Perhaps Monsanto is supporting you on that.
Love relationship, huh? What I find tricky is that my background is in science and technology history. And unfortunately, the scientific system, and I am absolutely pro-science, right? But the scientific system can be flawed, and it can be flawed by corporate influence. If you consider that Monsanto's main business has been the combination of Roundup plus GMO, and GMOs are super important for their main pesticide Roundup in this case, then anybody who's going against the main core part of their business, of course they want to discredit them. Of course they want to take them down. And then you have industry-funded studies, loads of them, or industry-influenced studies, and something called astroturfing. I love this term. Astroturfing.
Astroturfing. Actually,
which if the industry is funding these grassroots movements that sound like organizations made by like individual people or by scientists that come together, but actually it's just a lobbying organization that is pretending like these are just people who know and care about this cause, who want to promote science. These are just a few of the reasons why it's so, so hard to look through it, because it's like, oh, so this institution says it's safe, but then you need to research. I spend like, I don't know, 3 hours just digging, trying to find the funding sources of institutions to get down. And then you need to look at the funding sources of the funding sources. And then you maybe get to, buyer, surprise. Yeah.
That's true. That's really true.
Yeah. And then the question is, what are the alternatives, right? So could you get the same result maybe with other approaches that are possibly less risky?
To keep this episode bite-sized and easy to digest, it will keep going next week, so make sure to subscribe to stay up to date. Now think about one person that may appreciate learning about this topic and seeing different perspectives. The best thing that you can do to support Red to Green is to share this episode with that one person. It will just take 30 seconds and it will actually support us greatly to keep doing this research and bringing it out to you for free.
Frank and I would also love to hear from you. So go ahead, reach out to us, tell us your opinion, share your viewpoints, ask your questions. You can find the link to our profiles in the show notes or write us by looking us up, Frank Alexander Kühne and me, Marina Schmid. As so often, a big special thank you to our senior audio editor, Celeste Gupta. Until next time, let's move the food industry from harmful to healthy, from polluting to sustainable, from red to green.